episode 68 of Conversations with Kenyatta. This week, Kenyatta D. Berry, author of The Family Tree Toolkit and host of PBS's Genealogy Roadshow, is joined by Dr. Manisha Sinha. She is currently a professor in American history at the University of Connecticut and recently published her second book, The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic, Reconstruction 1860 through 1920.
Well, welcome to Conversations with Kenyatta. I'm excited to have you here today, Manisha. If you could tell me a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, you know, and why you became a historian, that would be fantastic.
So I was born and I grew up in India, and I was born into a family of historians. My father wrote a lot of military history in his spare time. All my brothers and sisters studied history. So it seemed inevitable that I would be a historian because we always had these huge historical discussions and debates over the dinner table. And I decided to study U.S. history and ended up coming to the United States to get my PhD.
And why did you choose U.S. history? What intrigued you about the United States?
So I grew up in the aftermath of the civil rights movement. And like many people growing up in India in the 70s and early 80s, we were really aware of how Dr. King's ideas of nonviolent resistance really connected with Mahatma Gandhi's notion of satyagraha, fight for the truth. And I saw all kinds of connections between the fight for Black rights in the United States with decolonization in Africa and Asia and India. And I just started reading a lot of American history on my own. I remember reading, you know, Letters from the Birmingham Jail. I remember reading the autobiography of Malcolm X and Anne Moody, Coming of Age in Mississippi. And I really got interested in this issue of race and democracy in the United States. Getting interested in those issues just sort of went back to the history of enslavement and emancipation in this country.
And so leading into that, race and democracy in the U.S., as I was preparing for this conversation, there's so much that I want to talk to you about because your interest, your vast interest, not only just in the slave trade, right? If we think about just the transatlantic slave trade, but also in the institution of slavery, abolitionist, and reconstruction. Those are four very, very big topics. So for each of those, starting with the slave trade, kind of what intrigued you there and sort of where has your work focused on the slave trade?
So my doctoral dissertation was really looking at the politics of slavery in the United States and pro-slavery ideology and the coming of the Civil War. And what I noticed was something that U.S. historians tended to downplay, and that is the movement to reopen the African slave trade. In fact, the one person who had written a very good monograph on that was the great activist and scholar W.E.B. Du Bois. His dissertation was on the suppression of the African slave trade. So in that first book, my dissertation that became my first book, The Counter-Revolution of Slavery, I looked not only at the politics of slavery, the argument for slavery developed by slaveholders, but also this concerted effort in the lower South states, in the Deep South, led by South Carolina to reopen the African slave trade. And then, of course, in my teaching, I always began with pre-colonial West Africa and the transatlantic slave trade instead of colonial America. So I went, you know, much further back than even 1619 when I taught courses in African American history.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting that you chose to focus on an area, because we'll get into your book, your dissertation that became your book, The Counter-Revolution of Slavery. But I find it interesting that you focused on kind of how South Carolina and the South wanted to reopen the slave trade, because that is not discussed at all, really. And, you know, that's one of the things I love about your work is that I always learned something very specific, you know, things that you wouldn't otherwise uncover. And so I want to put that on pause for a second or on hold. And then let's get to the next big topic, just slavery kind of in general. And so what aspects of that, because along with the slave trade. It's a very vast area to discuss and uncover. And so for you, as you were studying the slave trade, did that lead you to get deeper into the institution of slavery in the South?
Yes. You know, when I was in graduate school in the late 1980s, early 1990s, you had this fantastic new literature on the history of slavery, studying slavery from the bottom up, studying slavery from sources left by the enslaved. We just were developing new ideas about slavery, and the field was really growing. And what I thought was sort of odd was that those people who wrote Southern political history tended to ignore slavery, as if it had no impact on Southern politics. And, you know, they talked about, oh, white liberty based on black slavery. Most Southern whites believed in, you know, Republican ideas about themselves as good citizens and heads of households. And the presence of slavery was virtually ignored when it came to the political history of the South. So I chose to study the state of South Carolina. And of course, slavery was a widespread institution there. Unlike many states in the Upper South, it did not have a very big non-slaveholding area. In fact, the whole state was like one big plantation belt. And it stunned me to read books on South Carolina written by many people that said, oh, secession was a popular movement. It was a democratic movement among South Carolinians. And I lived at South Carolina where 60% of the population, the majority, were enslaved. Mm-hmm. And I just flipped it around and I said, this is not a democratic state where an overwhelming majority of its population is enslaved, and secession is not a popular democratic movement because most black people certainly were not part of it, not to mention even other whites who may have been intimidated and did not have a choice to vote against secession. So I really wanted to question this notion that somehow slavery could give rise to some sort of white democratic society. And I argued that even for white slavery, the presence of slavery led to a very anti-democratic, pro-slavery, reactionary kind of society and politics.
Mm-hmm. And so with your dissertation, I'm going to turn it to your book. Before mm-hmm. I get the full title for the audience, when you were writing this, I mean, I guess for someone who, you know, has come, you came at the time when there's a lot of new literature and things coming out about it. And I came kind of, you know, post that. Did you find resistance when you kind of were coming at it from the voices or the voices of the enslaved as opposed to the planter class that was kind of leading, as you say, the state of South Carolina that was one big plantation?
Yes, I did, especially amongst Southern political historians who did not like my book, did not like what I had to say. They felt that I should stick to my lane, which would be the social history of slavery, and leave the political history to them. And I remember as a graduate student in the early 1990s presenting in a panel with some really older gentlemen who did Southern political history. I was the only woman in that panel and certainly the only non-white person in that panel. And I had to hold my own against all of them. It was a very big session with lots of people in the audience. And I remember one of my advisors from Columbia University, Barbara Fields, who's a Southern historian and from whom I learned a lot about Southern history, sitting right up in front to sort of encourage me. And at the end of the session, she said, I think you're going to be just fine. So I imagine I held my own. But there was a lot of pushback by historians and some of their students who wrote quite nasty reviews of the book sometimes. Yeah, and not all of them were bad. In fact, some of the leading historical journals, I had good reviews. But there were others associated with this sort of Southern political history of white liberty based on black slavery that were somewhat negative. And I remember reading them and my advisor, Eric Foner, said, just ignore them. Don't pay any attention. And I didn't. And by the time the 1619 Project came along, the article on the politics of slavery written by Jamil Bowie actually leaned a bit on my book and its thesis on the anti-democratic nature of the politics of slavery.
That's such a great lead-in. I'm always curious, you know, being a historian, being a woman, being, you know, non-white person of color, how, and when you're talking about slavery, how that's perceived, especially when we know who's usually in the room. And I'll just leave it that at that point. But your book that became your dissertation, that became your book, a book, is The Counter-Revolution of Slavery, So Politics and Ideology in Antebellum South Carolina. Now, this book was named one of the 10 best books on slavery in Politico. And it, as you mentioned, was featured in a New York Times 1619 Project. So we know this came out of sort of your work or your dissertation. As you studied South Carolina, what were some of the most, I guess, kind of surprising things that you uncovered, whether it was about the enslaved, the enslavers, just the politics or the state overall? Did you have any very interesting stories that you wanted to share?
Yes. You know, I was surprised at how extreme South Carolinian politics was. And maybe I shouldn't have been, because everyone used to talk about the problem of South Carolina. But while other historians saw it as an outlier, as extremist, I argued precisely because it was so reactionary in its adherence to slavery, even going to the extent of wanting to reopen the African slave trade, that one can see South Carolina leading the secession movement in the Deep South. It's the first state to secede from the Union as soon as Lincoln is elected. Interestingly, they secede to object to the results of a presidential election. So the anti-democratic nature of secession is evident. What surprised me was how much they repudiated the American Revolutionary heritage. There's this common myth that, you know, Southerners evoked the American Revolution when they seceded from the American Union. But in fact, a lot of South Carolinians are explicitly writing against the American Revolutionary heritage, against the Declaration of Independence. And what I liked most was an enslaved man from South Carolina. This was my favorite incident from South Carolinian history. He runs during the Civil War into the Union Army, and he says the moment slaveholders rebelled against the American flag and put up their own rag, as he put it, to fight for the Confederacy, I knew that I would be loyal to that flag. The flag under which I had labored as an enslaved person for so long now is willing to die for it. And that was such a remarkable thing for him to say. And that always surprised me how politically aware and skilled enslaved people were. We don't think of slaves as having any kind of political savvy. We think of them being totally oppressed. We don't think of them as resisting in many ways and having political information or knowledge. And I ended my book with this incident that I discovered with the firing on Fort Sumter, which was an enslaved man in Fort Sumter is already writing to his mother and saying, you know, now we have to kind of rise up and join the Union forces, and this is the end of slavery. So they immediately knew the lay of the land, and in a way that, you know, was not something I expected to find, but I did find them in the records.
I think it's very interesting you mentioned that, because the oppression and the viewpoint of slavery, you know, as a descendant of enslaved individuals, I often find it fascinating because the enslaved were not obviously seen as human, but they were often just overlooked in a way in which they had, you know, those that were able to hear and see had eyes and ears. They may not have been able to read or write, but they were, mm-hmm. you know, not all enslaved people, you know, there were some, they were very intelligent, right? And there were mm-hmm. folks that ran the gamut of that. And so if I'm in a room as an enslaved person and you're talking politics, you don't see me because I just blend in. But that doesn't mean I don't hear what you're saying. And so to me, I just think that is something that's natural, because, you know, no matter what the other older schools of thought around slavery, most enslaved individuals were not happy about it, didn't want to be a part of it. And there were no good enslavers. I mean, it's all of that stuff needs to be thrown out the window that we have heard, at least over the years. So that's, I like those stories. And let's just stick with South Carolina, actually, because I do have someone, a friend of mine, her second great grandfather's from there. I don't have any South Carolina descendants that I know, or ancestors, I should say, that I know of. But what resources, you know, as a genealogist and you as a historian, what resources did you have available to you to really dig deep to find these types of stories, the stories in the enslaved individual, at least to understand these political views? Kind of, did you go to archives? How did you really gather material for your dissertation?
So for my dissertation, I actually ended up spending a year in South Carolina and even writing a letter to the local newspaper against the flying of the Confederate battle flag on state grounds, which was finally taken down in 2015 after the attack on the Amy Church. I spent a lot of time in archives, in the state archives in Columbia, South Carolina, in the South Caroliniana Library, where they have a lot of manuscripts left mainly by enslavers and planter politicians. And they mention enslaved people, they sometimes mention what they're doing, and you can really get a glimpse of enslaved lives through these men and their records. I also spent some time at Charleston, South Carolina, in the South Carolina Historical Society and their materials. So the whole year was spent just researching South Carolina history. And as far as enslaved people are concerned, you know, we have so many sources from enslaved people. We have the Federal Writers Project of the WPA, with the caveat that many of those people who were interviewed were in fact children under slavery, and many of them were interviewed by white Southerners. So how they answered those questions really depended on those circumstances. But most importantly, we had slave narratives. And those, I think, are even more authentic. A lot of them, like Frederick Douglass's narrative, were written by enslaved people who had managed to escape slavery and leave behind their memories and their experiences of slavery right then. So, you know, I didn't understand why historians would pay more attention to planter diaries than they would to these sources from enslaved people. So for South Carolina, you know, there was a wonderful narrative left behind by Jacob Stroyer that I used in my dissertation, and especially towards the end. So, you know, it's not a matter of that there are no sources. It's what you choose to look for.
And I like that. I appreciate you going through that process. And even now, I think just not, even if you're not writing a book as extensive as yours or doing dissertation, spending time in the place you're researching, spending time, you know, boots on the ground, so to speak, as opposed to behind a computer, even with all the records that have been digitized, is really important. You get a feel for the records. I think you understand how to access those records in other locations and work with them. And that was one of the things in genealogy that we try to stress, especially for folks that are starting out, when they think most things are online, when indeed you have to go to the courthouse, you have to go to the archives, you have to go to the societies to get access as well. So let's switch gears and get into the third topic, and that's abolition. And so your book, The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, won the 2017 Frederick Douglass Prize, and it has been described as a groundbreaking history of abolition that uncovers largely forgotten roles of African Americans and the long march towards emancipation from the Revolution through the Civil War. That's a lot to uncover and discuss. And I know you spent a year in South Carolina with your dissertation. So let's start with The Slave's Cause. What was the research and writing process like for that book?
So I wrote The Slave's Cause and researched it for a very long time, over a decade. And I was teaching at the University of Massachusetts, and I was near abolitionist sources, if you will. You know, I was near the Boston Public Library, which has the anti-slavery collection. At that point, already the Black Abolitionist Project had begun. And I actually read sources from that project in microfilm, in printed material, and then finally digitized, so all three versions. And it's not as if people hadn't written about Black abolitionists before. They had. Benjamin Quarles wrote a wonderful book in the 1970s on Black abolitionists. But the point that I was trying to make in the slave scores is that we really need to place African Americans in the broader movement. Because if we don't do that, then we don't get a sense of the leadership role that they played in the abolition movement as tacticians, as people who developed ideas and theories of abolition. We know that many of the most radical abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison got their ideas from African Americans. So I wanted to sort of center Black people in the history of abolition. Others besides Quarles who had written on Black abolitionists tended to dismiss them as minor players in the movement, who were at the receiving end of racial condescension and racism, so therefore they had no impact. And I definitely wrote against that strain of thinking. I also wrote against those people in popular circles, but also in academia, who really looked at abolition as kind of a white middle-class northern movement, that it was relatively conservative on race and economics. And instead, I was looking at Black people, I was looking at ordinary men and women in the movement, and I got a much better sense of a very diverse, radical social movement. And initially, I thought I would just concentrate in the decades before the Civil War. But inevitably, I found myself going back to the revolutionary era, sometimes even to the colonial era and to early modern Europe, because there were Africans there writing against slavery and against racism. So I argue that the abolition movement really begins with the very enslavement of people of African descent, because they are the first to sort of raise their voices against racial slavery, against modern racial slavery. So I ended up writing this big book that went from the Revolution to the Civil War, but really trying to challenge the prevailing sort of conventional wisdom about the movement against slavery. And I was also just happy to write about people I actually liked, because I had written about slaveholders and, you know, I had read everything that they had written, including John C. Calhoun, who was an ardent defender of slavery and kind of an unreconstructed racist. And so I just enjoyed reading the ideas and thoughts of people who actually fought against slavery.
And we'll get to your newest book in a few minutes further down the road. But I'm seeing a pattern here in that it seems that you take what has sort of, you look at what kind of maybe the conventional sort of wisdom or argument or theory around something as it relates to whether it's the slave trade or, you know, it's the politics of slavery or abolition. And you kind of turn it on its head and really come at it at a different angle. And so do you think that approaching it from that perspective comes from your upbringing, comes from sitting around the table discussing history and how you kind of got to the U.S. and reading about civil rights? Do you think that's part of it?
Yes. I mean, I definitely think it plays into my ideas. I mean, I, you know, developed a passion for history very young. And I think someone coming into the U.S. who's non-white is able to look at the history of slavery and race and racism through different kinds of lenses than is conventionally done. I was also lucky with my second book that I taught in an Afro-American studies department for 20 years. That was my home department. I had a position in the history department, but my home department was Black studies. And I think I really benefited from that because I was trained as a very conventional historian as a graduate student. But being in the Black Studies department, I was reading African American literature, Black thought, and the people who were in my department were the kind of people that I had read about, you know, like Mike Helwell, I had read about SNCC and I had read about the civil rights movement, and suddenly he's my colleague. Or people like, you know, Archie Shepp, who was a great jazz musician, or Bill Strickland, who, you know, began the movement for Black studies, Black world studies. He was one of the pioneers in the field. Or Ernie Allen, who was in the revolutionary auto workers movement of the 60s. So these people really had a certain kind of sensibility that they brought to Black studies. And I had a lot of colleagues who did Black literature, because it was not just history. Mm-hmm. And I was able to really expand our understanding of abolition by looking at early Black writing and early Black literature. And I remember many historians telling me, that's not historical evidence. And I was like, of course it is. If you want to look at Black anti-slavery thought, you have to look at early Black writing. You have to look at the poems of Phyllis Wheatley. You have to look at the sermons of Richard Allen. You have to look at the speeches of someone like James Forten. Otherwise, you miss what Black abolitionists are saying. So I think I also really benefited, not just my background coming from, you know, post-colonial India, independent India, being brought up in a society that was not colonial, unlike my father, who had memories of colonial rule, but also teaching in a department that brought a certain perspective to African-American history. And I ended up writing with a colleague a documentary history of African-Americans, where we simply compiled a lot of documents of Black history from the colonial era to the 21st century. And I think being in that department certainly shaped how I wrote the slave scores.
Okay. And that's awesome. I'm happy that, and I appreciate that you were open enough to, you know, just not stay in the historian lane, so to speak, but to, like a sponge, absorb all these other thoughts and pieces of information to kind of help present your book and your view. And, you know, when I haven't studied abolition a lot and abolitionists, I mean, maybe from a, like, where to get the records perspective. And we talked a little bit about the misconceptions around Black abolitionists as them being like ineffective because they, you know, in the movement or because they're looked down upon. But what are some of the misconceptions about white abolitionists? And I ask that question because I feel like a lot of times when you hear the stories of maybe someone downplaying a white abolitionist downplaying a Black abolitionist, and you think of it's like this patriarchal type of thing or something, right? Like they're saving us, you know, so to speak. Is that really what it was like? Or were there folks that were in it for the movement, for the cause, just because they felt it was right?
So that's a really interesting question, because there were so many white abolitionists who had to be programmatically, at least, committed not just to ending slavery, but also to Black equality, to ending segregation in the North, and for citizenship rights for Black people. And they all, on a formal, programmatic level, agreed to that. But of course, there were many instances of racial condescension towards African Americans. But that is not where the story ends. Mm-hmm. I would read the minutes of many of these abolition meetings, and immediately I would see Black abolitionists stand up and call these people on it. And so I think what the abolition movement did was something rather unique in antebellum America, which is to create a space, and it's probably the only space, where white and Black Americans could come together and confront each other and even learn from each other. And I had a different view of white abolitionists. I did not see them all as unremittingly racist. In fact, compared to a majority, an overwhelming majority of white Americans, they were not half bad. And they, in many instances, were good allies, I think, of the Black freedom struggle. I also revisited some of the big sort of conflicts between Black and white abolitionists, like the big break between William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass. That is always told through the lens of racism. And in fact, I found something much more there. There was serious philosophical disagreements between the two, and it became very personal because they had been so close to each other. So it was really like a family quarrel, virtually, with each hitting the other below the belt. So there was that personal angle to it too. So I really dug deep into the records. And when it came to white abolitionists, I was really not interested in hearing what the historians had said, because most historians had misrepresented them, especially Garrison. People just can't get over his philosophical radicalism and they attack him all the time. I was more interested in seeing what contemporary Black abolitionists were saying about these white abolitionists, or what contemporary Black people were saying, because that, I felt, is more accurate historically than what historians were saying. Similarly, a lot of people were very dismissive of the work of Phyllis Wheatley when I wrote the book. Now, of course, that has changed completely. There are several good books on Phyllis Wheatley, and I felt I really could read her poetry, and even though I'm not a literary scholar, I spent a lot of time trying to decipher her personal letters, her poems, to understand how she critiques slavery and racism in the early American Republic. So, yeah, I, you know, again, as you said, I tended to argue against the grain, mainly because I decided I'm not going to make any generalizations or any conclusions that are not supported by the historical record. And a lot of times people do that, and a lot of times they get things wrong. I also learned which historian to trust and which historian not to trust when it came to the history of abolition. So that was interesting too.
That's interesting. And thank you for that answer. I you know, it's always good to kind of dig deeper to especially when you're going against the grain, because that's difficult to do. And I appreciate that. That's something I like to do. So let's get into your new book, The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic. Reconstruction, 1860 to 19. Reconstruction, I will say, is one of my favorite areas, just because I don't feel like there's enough work done on Reconstruction, especially in genealogy, my personal opinion. But it's also the most frustrating area for me too, as well. So I wanted, for you, what was the inspiration for this book, for your new book?
So I never thought I'd write a book on Reconstruction. My mentor had written the book on Reconstruction. It was published in the late 1980s. But increasingly, my students would always, when I taught the big Civil War and Reconstruction class, completely follows Civil War. So I was able to, you know, lecture broadly on the consequences of the Civil War and look at Reconstruction. And they could just never understand how we could make so much progress in such a short time and then fall back so badly into the Jim Crow South. And that, you know, they kept asking me questions. They wouldn't let me stop with the end of Reconstruction. Like, what happened after that? How is it that this happened? We want to know the broader story. Why did the North and the Republican Party, the federal government, just abandon this project that they were so committed to for so many years? You know, what's happening in the United States and across the globe? So those questions always remained with me, and I started fashioning my lectures to their answers, and that became the genesis for this book. Initially, after writing The Slaves Course, I didn't want to write another big book. It had just taken a lot out of me, and I said, okay, I'll just write a dual biography of Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner, the two leading radical Republicans that W.E.B. Du Bois called the seers of American democracy. And my editor, who read the proposal, said, I think this is a new book on Reconstruction. I think you should write a new book on Reconstruction. It's about time. So I was a little hesitant in the beginning because I felt, you know, Eric Foner's book on Reconstruction was like the gold standard. You know, how could I even imagine to try and, you know, emulate that? But I ended up then writing a very different book than his book and other previous books on Reconstruction. And the argument that I was making, again, shaped by my students' questions, is that Reconstruction doesn't really just dramatically end in 1877 when the last Reconstruction governments fall in the South, in Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina. That in fact, we can look at this long process of the unwinding of Reconstruction from 1877 up to 1900, like the latter half of the 19th century. And so I really paid attention to this long unwinding of Reconstruction, the rise of formal legal disfranchisement, the rise of Jim Crow with Plessy versus Ferguson, but also at other things that happened at the same time and that reinforce this reactionary period. It's labor strife and the takeoff of industrial capitalism in the North. It's the conquest of the last indigenous nations in the West and the rise of American empire with the Spanish-Cuban-American War and the annexation of Hawaii and the colonization of the Philippines. And suddenly I could see how the long afterlives of slavery bled into the rise of American imperialism, and that the fall of Reconstruction's interracial democracy really had this terrible and tragic influence on American democracy as a whole, as the Southern dream of, you know, racial subjugation, what we could even call Jim Crow colonialism, is being even imported abroad, with the United States acquiring all these colonial territories. So I ended up writing, I also wanted to write more women's history than had been done in the past, and not just in the suffrage movement, but also looking at the struggles of freed women and later on of Black feminists like Ida B. Wells and Mary Church Terrell, but also social feminists like Jane Addams, who were trying to extend Reconstruction's notion that the state, that the nation state and the government are responsible for the welfare and well-being of all their citizens, regardless of class or color or previous condition of servitude or gender even. And so it became just a different book. I end the book with the 19th Amendment, which I say is the last Reconstruction Amendment because it is so modeled after the 15th Amendment that gave Black men the right to vote during Reconstruction.
Okay. So with that, that's fascinating and very interesting because that would have made that connection that you just described. And so the question I have, then let's take it back to sort of 1870s because this is what I've heard about, right? And you mention it and call it the corrupt bargain of 1877 that put Rutherford B. Hayes in the White House. I've heard little snippets about this, you know, as a kind of a student of Reconstruction a little bit. This is kind of the point I look at as where it all started to unravel. So kind of for the audience, what is that corrupt bargain? What did that mean exactly?
Yes. So most historians of Reconstruction talk about the so-called compromise of 1877 that led to the election of Hayes to the presidency, the Republican candidate, but also to the unraveling of the last Reconstruction governments in the South. And, you know, historians in the past said, oh, there were some railroad interests involved. Others made other assumptions about this so-called compromise of 1877. Recent historians have even questioned whether such a compromise formally took place. What I can say very clearly is the results of what happened, which was this odd phenomenon where the electoral votes of Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina go to Hayes, and he becomes president. But at the state level, the Republicans lose. The Democrats, who at that time, for your listeners who are confused, everything they know about the two-party system today, they should just reverse it. For the 19th century, the Democrats were the Conservative Party, the Republicans were the radical liberal party of Black rights. And so you have this strange phenomenon where, you know, these three states have Democratic state governments, but the electoral votes go to Hayes. So it seems as if the Republicans, and especially the so-called liberal Republicans who seem to come into power with the Hayes administration, have this attitude of not interfering in Southern affairs anymore, that the federal government would simply not interfere in Southern politics anymore, which meant that it was open season on Black people, that white elites, racist era could reign supreme and decide the results of elections in the South, which it pretty much did after 1877, even though we have instances of Black voting right up to formal disfranchisement in the 1890s, state constitutions beginning with Mississippi. But really, you're right, 1877 is the beginning of the unraveling. But I didn't want to just end there. I wanted to tell the story of that unraveling. I wanted to talk about the interracial governments that emerged in some Upper South states like North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia, where Black Republicans joined forces with populists or readjusters and other to challenge the sort of democratic conservative rule of white elites in the South. You know, something like the Wilmington Massacre of 1898, yeah. You cannot understand it unless you look at all that also. So besides looking at this moment in 1877, when under Hayes, the Republican Party formally retreats from enforcing Reconstruction. And again, it's not as if there weren't some Republicans later on who tried to evoke federal authority. There was the Lodge Bill that tried to ensure fair elections in the South. It was defeated, of course, in Congress. There was the Blair Bill that tried to establish a national system of education so that Black people would also benefit from an equal opportunity for education. All those bills are defeated. And the Supreme Court, of course, in the 1880s and 1890s, it seems what the Warren Court did is a real exception. The Supreme Court has generally played a reactionary role in the history of American democracy. And you can see how they go about systematically emasculating federal civil rights laws and Reconstruction amendments in the late 19th century, pretty much what they have done in the past few decades recently. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to tell that entire story. And I thought if I just stopped at 1877, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Right. No, I'm glad you decided to do that. And I want to just state the title of your book again, because I didn't state the full year. So it's The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic, Reconstruction 1860 to 1920. Not 1900, 1920. Before I get into some other questions just for you personally about your book, in writing this book, since it's, you always seem to come across some very interesting stories or nuggets. Was there anything that stood out in your research from either a good or bad perspective, or that you couldn't include in the book?
So from the bad perspective, what I found was that even when Reconstruction was at its height, in the late 80s, that even during its short-lived triumph, what astounded me was the level of racist political violence in the South. Mm-hmm. It's as if these people never accepted defeat. And part of it was that after Lincoln's assassination, they had a man, Andrew Johnson, who encouraged them in their opposition to Black rights, to the results of the war, to emancipation. But even then, the level of violence that you would read, if you looked at the papers of the Freedmen's Bureau, which is actually really helpful for genealogists, I know.
Yes.
But also, the investigations of the Joint Committee on Reconstruction, when they were gathering evidence of domestic terror in the South, that level of barbarity and brutality is actually really quite eye-opening. And I say that as a historian of Reconstruction who had read already other books that talked about this, many books that have talked about this. But even then, when you actually read those instances, it really curdles your blood. It's not pleasant reading. Mm-mm. And you realize how truly awful these people were. And the notion that somehow there should have been sexual reconciliation or they've been forgiven, I think they should have done what Charles Sumner suggested that we should do, which is to exile all these traitors. There was a bar against them from holding federal office in the 14th Amendment. But Congress passes an amnesty law, and these very same people are back in office. So much so that one of the leaders of the Ku Klux Klan, one of the leaders of these white terrorist groups in Louisiana, becomes a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So I, you know, that level of violence that one sees during Reconstruction and even after Reconstruction, you'd think they'd be happy after they had won, that they would stop. But the numbers of lynchings and racial massacres increase even during this period of the Jim Crow South. So that level of brutality, I think really if anyone thinks that slavery was benevolent or that these people were paternalistic towards Black people, they just have to read those records to have their eyes opened.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Freedmen's Bureau, and I do read those records a lot. And the Murders and Outrages report, those are the ones where I think in the work that I do around slavery, the enslaved, you know, I can view a document with an individual with a number attached to them. But sometimes when I read those reports is when I have to just shut the laptop and then just walk out because, you know, it's just, and the other part for me in those reports as well, is that someone's ancestor and it doesn't, may not even have a name attached to it. You know, this person was just minding their business, tended to their horse and somebody came and shot him. Like, it's just random stuff where you just can't believe it. And it's, but with that being said, I do feel like these are stories that need to be told and need to be discovered and not swept under the rug. Because the narrative is, you know, you get the narrative, it wasn't that bad. You get the narrative of, as it were, slavery. You get a narrative that doesn't show the violence towards, you know, the sexual violence towards women. The, you know, just kind of like trying to enslave people, kidnapping people, you know, keep them enslaved, kidnapping. All of those things that happened during that time when we were just trying to live and be citizens of the United States. That's pretty much it. And so I always look at that. And as hard as it is, I think it's very necessary. And I appreciate you, you know, continuing the work. And I appreciate you bringing a perspective from someone, you know, who wasn't born in the U.S. Because I feel like as a descendant of the enslaved, you know, the race relations between Blacks and whites in the U.S. is so deep that I think even for each group, you know, we're so entrenched in the viewpoint from the American viewpoint, if that makes sense, right? We're just so entrenched in our bubble of it. Sometimes I think it's hard to step outside of that. So I thank you for doing that. And I guess my next question for you, before I get to my last one, is, you know, with all the stuff, the work that you've done, what do you enjoy most about being a historian?
Well, I have to admit that I love the research. I love going to archives. I love spending the time doing research. And I was really lucky that during the pandemic, I had a fellowship where I could go to the archives still masked. And this is even before vaccinations, but I could continue my work at the American Antiquarian Society. I was just like really lucky. It was as if someone was watching over me. I was on leave for 2 years during the pandemic, and I was able to research this book and write it during the time when the whole world shut down. So in this, an excitement of just like going to an archive, opening a newspaper or opening a letter from someone and reading something and finding things that you may or may not be looking for, and just finding that evidence to make an argument, I still like that old-fashioned historical method where you just, you know, tough it out, you go to the archives and you do your work. I also like the fact that I'm not one of those who thinks that, oh, I'm just going to, you know, write from a blank slate. You know, so many people have written on these topics, so many historians, and I lean on them. I lean on all the different historians who have come before me and who've written on all these topics. As I told you, I learn who to trust and who not to trust. But I think a lot of times when people write, they want to write as if they've discovered something entirely new. And they tend to dismiss previous historical scholarship. So for me, it's never been that. It's not just the primary research. It's also all the secondary material that I read, you know, by historians who may have even written in the early 20th century. So they are forgotten Black historians who were writing these amazing histories of Reconstruction. Everyone knows W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction, but there were others who were publishing in that time, it was called the Journal of Negro History, and who were writing books like L. Ruthius Taylor. He wrote all these books on Reconstruction on different states that I found really useful. So I also like reading other historians. I just like history. I like reading history. I like researching history. So that's my process as a historian. If I'm writing on a topic, I don't just have to do research on it. I have to literally read everything that has ever been written about it. And that's why maybe it takes me so long to write. But in a way, even if you don't use all that material, it gives you a kind of a deeper understanding than a more superficial sort of analysis would.
I like that. That's great. So with all of that research and writing and the love of research, I love research as well. What's next for you? Are you working on another book, another project?
Yes, I have a kernel of an idea right now. It's literally a kernel, because not even a seed, because I've just finished this book on Reconstruction, and I've been really talking about this book. But at one point, I want to write a history of feminism. And everyone says, oh, you don't think small, do you? You always come up, I guess I'll never write a micro history. But I do want to write not a broad women's history, but very specifically a history of feminism and feminist thought. It's something that I've always wanted to do. And I'm like, why not? At this point, you know, I don't have to answer to anyone. I can pretty much write what I want to write. So I said, maybe that'll be the next big project.
Oh, great. Well, I look forward to reading it, to hearing about it. And thank you so much. This conversation has been great. I have a ton of questions, but I'm sure the audience, you can come back for part two, but this has been fantastic. And thank you so much for joining Conversations with Kenyatta.
Thank you so much for having me.
Conversations with Kenyatta is produced by Kenyatta D. Berry and Caitlin Owl, and features Kenyatta D. Berry. The music for this episode was Good Vibe by Ketza. Follow Kenyatta on Instagram under the handle kenyatta.berry, on Facebook at facebook.com/kenyattadb, and on Twitter at kenyattadb. You can also find more information on her book and upcoming events on her website at kenyattaberry.com. As a reminder, the views expressed by guests on Conversations with Kenyatta are their own and do not reflect the views of Kenyatta D. Berry.